This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we're going to be talking about something that is not talked about enough anymore. This world we live in, I mean our world of Dreamland and all the other shows, Area 52, etc., etc., is a world now of will disclosure happen or not? Okay, I get it. We are going to definitely be staying in that space from time to time. But there are things about us that we really need to focus on. Things that we are going past. We think, oh, I know all about that. Forget it. I can't do it. I can, etc. There's a miracle here. And today we're going to be talking about some things about that miracle that you probably don't know with someone who knows a great deal about them. Von Brashler is with us, and Von has been thinking about and working on and the idea of lucid dreaming and how to make it work for you for a long time. Von, I'd like to welcome you to Dreamland.
Thank you, Whitley. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pleasure to be back with you, too. Now, you've written this book about lucid dreaming. Why did you happen to do that? I'm curious.
Yes, well, I'd written a couple of earlier books on dreams, and mostly it seems that people are interested in the fascination of a dream. It's so exciting to talk about. It's entertaining. It's something that just seems to happen sporadically without a lot of thought or deep analysis. And I find that going back over the history of dream work, that civilizations for like at least 5,000 years have depended very much on the power of dreams as being prophetic, divine connection, inspiration, insight, very meaningful encounters where one apparently in a state of heightened consciousness steps outside and discovers something that's just not in our brain memory. And so based on my own experience with dreaming and my fascination with the lucid dream, I embarked on a plan, a procedure, if you will, to develop steps whereby a person could actually enter lucid dreams and begin to mine this great field of exploration. Continuing dreams, returning to dreams, doing what the ancients called dream work. And it took me down a lot of rabbit holes, but I primarily went through what the people in Eastern spiritual science called yoga and consciousness training. And I found out there was a lot written and a lot to be learned from the East.
So, yeah, and this goes back in the history of the Western world as well. Yes. And someone like Terence McKenna would have said that it's related to the use of substances that release a lot of DMT
in the
blood. But a lucid dream isn't it caused by a natural release of DMT in the body? Can you tell us a little bit about how lucid dreams set up in the body? How do they happen?
Yeah, I'm not the guest that could help you there. I'm sorry. I don't have a scientific training. I've looked at what research there is in dreams in the West. It seems to be kind of skewered toward what I like to call material reductionist philosophy. And I think that we're selling it short and that we can quantify it with measurements known to Western science. It is something quite different. It is consciousness, which is non-material. It is human empowerment, energy, which is non-material. And I think if we try to actually quantify it through material scientific methods, I think we're selling the process short. That's just my own take.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I asked the question, and I guess I framed it incorrectly because I wasn't asking for the scientific material about how dreams emerge. Let me go in a slightly different direction. Let's tell us the difference between common dreams and lucid dreams. That I
Yeah,
think that might be the best way to go with this.
that's certainly. Now, most of us have experienced what we call common dreams or very routine dreams. And these are sometimes called nightmare dreams or restless dreams. These are dreams of night sweats. They're dreams that come to you based on the fact that your physical side, your body, and your physical mind have not been really put to sleep during sleep time. And the mind, then, as a part of your physicality, just continues to grind away at concerns that you haven't been able to analyze and resolve in your waking moments. So in a sleepy state, we are still working on our problems and trying to develop new scenarios to analyze them and hopefully resolve them. This is a very common dream, and this is it's an insight to your psychology, and this is where people usually have their dreams analyzed psychologically. But a lucid dream is a dream where you're fully conscious of being in the dream. You're fully conscious in the dream. You have awareness. Conscious awareness in the dream, you're acting with great awareness, and you're in control of this dream.
Now, in control is an interesting word phrase because I've had lucid dreams. I don't have many, I will say that, but some of them have been extremely lucid, to say the least. And I've been able to move around in these worlds independently as if they were real, and maybe they are. What do you say to that? Could it be that sometimes these that part of our beings opens us up to other realities that we can actually enter?
Exactly. That's the point of why I've written any of these books is that in my next book we'll explore the subtle energy bodies that we have, looking at our emotional body or mental body or causal body or spiritual body, looking at the totality of our whole self being more than simply our physical nature. It is my understanding through research and personal exploration that we have consciousness, energized consciousness, existing on all levels of our total being, including our subtle energy bodies. Therefore, one can leave in a lucid dream. And when I say leave, I say that you're in an altered state. Of leaving the room where you're reclining, and you're actually going somewhere, and you're following a path that your subtle energy bodies, fully energized and conscious, have allowed you to go. Therefore, you can go to an astral plane, you can go to a mental plane, you can go to a causal plane, you can go to higher spiritual planes. And it is my belief then that most of us who don't explore dream work in this fashion are living just the tip of the iceberg of our total human potential.
Exactly. We are less We are made to believe, or tricked into believing, that we are less than we actually are, and in part that's because of this absolutely amazing material world we live in, where it is so hard to see beyond the latest thing. You know, we're constantly addicted. We're all addicted to our phones now. Anyone who tells me they're not addicted to their phone doesn't have a smartphone. And you know, I'd like to not have a smartphone, but I can't get rid of it because I need it too badly in my life. So there we have it. Now, but this is a the reason we're here. One of the many reasons we're here today is this is an escape hatch. This is an escape into a higher level of us, level of us that's much more important somehow or another than doom scrolling. Let's put it that way.
We're talking about parallel realities, parallel worlds, parallel universes, parallel existences. We're talking about the other aspects of you that most people don't explore. They just simply refuse to say there's anybody there. There's no other room outside this room. There's no presence for you there. There's no opportunity for you there. There's no there there. You know, and it's just simply not true. There are many aspects of us that need to be explored. The ancients could do it. Going back to the Egyptians, the Babylonians, they could all explore it. The Greeks, the Romans, and then suddenly we come upon the age of reason and science. We say that, oh, only that can be what can be measured physically in terms of length and weight counts. It just isn't so.
Isn't there a kind of a long decline here, in the sense that the Egyptians and the Middle Eastern peoples in the very early days, the Persians, were masters of the dream.
Masters of the
No
dreams.
way to other way to describe it. Then the Greeks come along, and suddenly Plato and Aristotle are talking about the world in a different way, and in some senses a bigger way. But the life of dream still is extremely important and remains so into the early modern period, when it becomes the Inquisition, or the late Middle Ages, when the Inquisition comes along in the West, and people become afraid to mention their dreams lest they be accused of being of consorting with demons.
Oh, you've yes,
You could
you
get,
found the problem. This is it. You know, when religion got involved in our dream world, then it was considered taboo to even have dreams, certainly to mention dreams or to reflect on dreams. They were something of the devil, you know, and dare I say, Christianity led this wave of inquisitions, because we see in all of these traditions, and throughout the world, and in various religious world religions, the dreams were very important. You know, very important. You know, if you look into the Christian Bible, you can find, I think it's like three dozen references to dreams. That dreams were extremely important. You know, David, Jacob, Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, the many, many, many dreams. It's
Well, of course, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar is a very famous dream.
yes.
I mean, can you outline it for my listeners just briefly, or because I can't either.
Not exactly a biblical scholar, but the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, as I recall, was interpreted by a prophet in the Bible and explained to him. There were dreams of pharaohs, there were dreams of kings that were often interpreted by dream advisors, if you will. And in going back to Genesis, it's described that a dream is a profound and connection to God. It is a divine connection to God. And if you look back, and you bring up Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle was the one who started us categorizing everything. I kind of blame him for everything. But
Yeah, well, he's.
let's back up. I mean, honestly, in terms of the dream history, Aristotle was a great believer in lucid dreams. He believed that one could actually diagnose illness in a dream, which I totally believe in and practice, and I've tried to teach it in workshops, that one can actually enter a dreamscape and energize yourself to determine what is what. I dare not say diagnose for fear I'll be arrested, but one can determine what might be at the root of one's problem in terms of health, whether it be physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual. And then to energize yourself, to rejuvenate yourself, and then to find a special dream place where one can go to become well. Well, Aristotle knew this, and certainly the father of medicine, Hippocrates, knew this. And they believe that dreams, in addition to being a dream work of prophecy and divine connection and insight, would also be a means of self-healing.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty with Vaughn about how do we make this work? When I'm having a lucid dream, I know I'm having a lucid dream, and it's incredibly cool when it happens. Two questions I'm going to ask. One, can I induce this? And two, if I have one, what do I do with it? We'll be right back. We're talking to Vaughn Brashler about his book, Lucid Dreaming. Vaughn, you have a website, don't you?
Yes, it's simply Von Brashler website at .com.
VaughnBrashlerWebsite.com.
.com.
Okay, I have learned, by the way, from long experience, that if I say the guest's website, people, it goes one in one ear and out the other, but I ask the guest, then they remember. So go to VaughnBrashlerWebsite.com and you will be able to explore how to interact with Vaughn and how to get involved in, for example, his workshops. I mean, you can do this, folks. This is very empowering. How do we? I want a lucid dream. What do I do?
Well, I've reached a point in my life with pets and age and health, frankly, Whitley, that I don't do the workshops the way I did.
Oh, you don't
I,
anymore. I'm
no.
so sorry.
So I did, and so I wanted to write this book to show how to program one's own a do-it-yourself on how to program one's own lucid dreams, and it was based largely on my experience teaching for a short while at the Omega Institute for Holistic Health, where I took a group of people that had never experienced lucid dreaming and, in a short amount of time, trained them how to do it themselves and do it really effectively. And it was just amazing that one could actually set up steps to enter a lucid dream. So the steps are not really complicated, but the first step is to actually induce a state of sleep that is deeper than most people experience in their sleep mode. Now, one can go into a lucid dream, even in a daydream, even seated in a chair, even lying on a mat, even reclining on a sofa. I've done it walking, but most people find it more conducive for deep dreaming to actually go and program a dream that would happen during normal sleep time. So what I do is I try to get people trained to get into a deeper state of sleep. Now, earlier on, when I was really fascinated with meditation, I found that most people had a difficulty in reaching a state that was deep enough to be considered a deep meditative state that would actually allow them to enter a state of altered consciousness. So I knew right away that most people were not allowing themselves to get into a deep sleep mode. So I go into this explanation of how to induce a state of deep sleep, and I ended up landing on self-hypnosis, where people would very much like in meditation, consciously put their body to sleep, beginning with their toes, their legs, their torso, their chest, their arms, their head, all the way to the tip of their head, and then finally putting their physical mind, their brain, to sleep. This is extremely important. And I found then that most people had a problem, which I call the gatekeeper, and that is the physical mind, the brain, would now not allow people to surrender to allow your inner consciousness to come forward. In other words, they couldn't enter a state of heightened consciousness because their physical analytical brain, this little pocket calculator that runs our lives, was not allowing them to surrender to their inner consciousness. And so they couldn't enter a state of heightened consciousness. They couldn't enter a state of meditation. They couldn't enter deep sleep. They couldn't enter lucid dreams. So I introduced the concept of harmony that allows one's self to surrender the control long enough for the mind as well as the physical body to enter a state of deep sleep so that the inner consciousness or super consciousness or your inner self to come forward and take you into a dream. Now, that in a nutshell is what's involved. Beyond that, I use creative visualization so that people would actually develop an agenda of where they want to go and what they want to explore in a lucid dream, so that the dream is mapped out. Everybody who has ever planned for a trip anywhere knows you have to have a plan. You need to know what you're going to take with you. You need to know where you're going to go and how you're going to get there. And it's the same with a dream adventure. To set up a lucid dream, you need to have an agenda. So I use creative visualization, but I do this in a different way. I encourage people to have visual drawings or create pictures in their mind of where they want to go and what they want to explore. I think it's important when you set up lucid dream to stop all this analytical thinking, which is only then inviting the physical brain into the process, which limits you. It is, after all, the gatekeeper. So if you picture where you're going to go, rather than think in terms of words or sounds, you're going to get there faster.
You mentioned the physical brain, and earlier you talked about subtle body. Can you tell us what you mean by subtle body, and is that where lucid dreaming unfolds?
Lucid dreaming will is possible by the fact that we have an aspect of ourselves, a greater aspect of ourself, which is more than the physical body. It is the fact that we have an energized body. We have aspects of ourselves which are like luminous or light bodies or energy bodies that exist. One is tempted to say outside the body, like a luminous egg. It's often described as the layers of an onion. But this then is once again a material reductionist way of looking at things. Just as we look at the chakra in the body as being vertically along the spine, this has no basis in physicality, because our subtle energy bodies, like our consciousness that resides on all of these levels, is non-physical. So we have to think of it as our connection to the mental realm, or the mental aspect of ourself. So as above, so below. So there would be like an emotional level to an astral level of reality. These are actually realms of being, and it is our connection to these realms of being that make the dreaming possible.
We're going to take another break, and when we get back, we're going to ask Fawn, what happens when somebody else enters your dreams? Okay, Vaughn, you know the question already. What does happen when someone else enters your dreams? Because I've had that happen many times, and I'm sure a lot of my viewers and listeners have too.
You can actually share a dream with somebody, and it can be set up. What I've done in dream experiments of a personal level is I found that if I have the person like in the same room or the next room, the proximity seems to help. And what also seems to help is if we actually set up the dream so that we actually have an idea of where we're going to go and what we're going to experience, and we set up the dream to begin at the same time and in the same place. In other words, we're simultaneously setting up a lucid dream. So what I found is that we tend to dream in these shared dreams with people that are close to us. They have an affinity to us. They have I don't know, kind of an electromagnetic attraction or a karmic attraction to us. There's a definite connection of some form that makes it possible to have a shared dream with somebody who is like a loved one, a sibling, a child, a parent, someone who's very close to us. I think that if someone is a close friend, that is very good. It's going to be easy to set up a shared dream with someone who shares your vision. And so you actually begin the dream and you start the dream at the same time. Now, this can be done with a per another person. This can also be done sporadically by somebody who is thinking about the same sorts of things that you are, and will actually have a dream that takes you to the same place. You will encounter sometimes groups of people that have a shared view of things with you, but you can actually have a group that actually will enter a shared dream. What I find interesting is that you will, in a dream state, often experience people that you know in the dream, or you might experience people that you've seen in previous dreams. These are your dream companions, if you will, and there will be a whole cast of people in your dreams that will recur from time to time. I think a lot of people have had experience with something called the upper room. In the upper room, people will be gathered in a circle, and someone will come out, open a door, stand in front of the group in the middle of the circle, and impart something of a personal importance to each member who's there. But they will then receive maybe a different message, and there will be a different message for each one of them. One thing you need to consider in your lucid dreaming is that it's a non-physical realm, and you're not going to have sound, you're not going to have the same experience with seeing and hearing, or any of the five physical senses that are known only to our physicality. But there are opportunities to share dreams that could be extremely meaningful for people who want to share a dream.
Sharing dreams is, it's interesting. You know, I used to share dreams sometimes with my wife Anne, and they were often quite a bit of fun, and we would set them up beforehand. But I never knew for sure whether because we set them up, we were actually just dreaming the same thing separately, or we were sharing. I couldn't tell the difference. Is there any way to tell the difference?
Yeah, I think that for me, the beauty of a shared dream is that you both go and you experience generally the same dream, maybe in a slightly different way, but it's very common that you have a common experience. And the beauty is that you can come back from the dream and then discuss the dream and then begin to sort some meaning from the dream. The dream will probably have a slightly different meaning for each one of you or both of you, but there will be some points of comparison. So I think the thing with a lot of dreaming is that people have no frame of reference. It's outside your physical memory. But if you're sharing a dream with somebody, you have a point of comparison and you can come back and discuss the dream and even then you can expand on the importance of the dream, get something out of it.
How do you have any suggestions about how to set up a shared dream?
Yeah, I think that the best way to do it is that you will recline side by side or very close to each other. You might even hold hands during the dream. It's just a thought. But you want to be very close to this person. You want to actually visualize the same place that you're going to go and what you want to experience. And when I say you visualize it, it doesn't have to be a precise drawing of where you're going to go, but it needs to be like an etch-a-sketch picture of where you think you need to go and what you need to experience. So you have an idea of where and when and what. And then you will have this shared setup, a shared setup in your mind as that you both visualize the same outcome or the same destination. So you set up the trip, you set up the adventure, and then you embark on it simultaneously at the same time. And then you, once you get there, need to both orient yourself to the fact that you're there, that you're aware of being in the dream. You're consciously aware of being in the dream. You have conscious awareness of acting in the dream and acting out, and you're empowered in the dream. This is an important aspect of lucid dreaming is empowerment, and that you're conscious of the other person being in the dream. So you're interacting in the dream, and then you can interact together in the dream. It can be very powerful.
I've had one really vivid lucid dream that I found rather disturbing in this sense. I found myself in a room. It was an office, but it was more like a home office with a man who I was vaguely familiar to me. I couldn't say that I recognized him. He was sitting there in a chair, not behind a desk, and I could actually walk around in the room. And he said to me, he looked up at me, and he said, "Hello, Whitley." And I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, we're just running a check. It'll be over in a minute." And then he asked me, pointed to the other side of the room. He said, "Can you go over there?" And I walked over the other side of the room, and it ended. What in the hell was going on, Ron? Do you have any ideas?
So I think that I've had kind of that kind of experience. It is case of a lot of dream teachers out there that are actually monitoring our dreams or interacting in our dreams or assisting in our dreams. And I've long noticed that when I started actually consciously setting up lucid dreams, planning them out, that I wasn't alone out there, that I was going to get some help, and that I would be kind of picked up by I don't know if they're spirits or what, but I call them Dreamland people. I don't know what they
Dreamland
are.
people, yeah. Well, this
Dreamland
isn't
people.
this. You're actually on Dreamland, so it's the
I'm
perfect.
on. So
Right.
I don't know if this is this could well be interdimensional. You know, if we want to get really down to brass tacks, I don't know what it is. As I say, I have no scientific background whatsoever. I've just simply studied the yoga of consciousness. But I think that there are let's say entities or spirits out there that are going to have a certain amount of interest in the fact that you're maneuvering outside your physical limited realm that occupies your daytime hours, and they have a fascination with that. One of my first teachers said, you know, when you begin to wander out there, Vaughn, you know, be aware, be advised, you know, you're not going to be alone. You know, you're going to encounter others, you know, and you know, heads up. He kind of said heads up. You know, he says, because it's kind of he described it to me as being in a railway station where the trains don't always arrive on time, and you don't always know where they're coming from. You don't know who's getting on and who's getting off, but you're going to be caught in a mad rush. So I think that sometimes when we enter a lucid dream, we're kind of wandering in on a story in the middle, and we're going to be bumping into people, and I think that we have to be ready for that. But I think that we're completely capable of negotiating in the dreamscape in this fashion because we are empowered. We do have a conscious empowerment in a dream.
You talk about a blank slate in the book, having a blank slate. How does that work? How do you create that, and what do you do with it?
I see. I think this is where it all kind of begins for me. It's where I first set up a conscious dreaming platform, was that I could actually form in front of my mind's eye, inside my head, I could see a blank slate. And when I reached the point where I would tune out my physical mind and I would become completely at rest, I would get to a point where I would see just a blank slate. And to me, that was a consciousness, I call it the great dark pool of consciousness. And out of that darkness, anything could come. I could fill it, see? So I begin to write on that slate wherever I wanted to go and whatever I wanted to do. I begin to understand that I had control of my own destiny, as long as I could begin with a blank slate inside my mind's eye.
That's very interesting. And how do you achieve that blank slate?
You get to that blank slate by totally tuning out the five physical senses. You're no longer hearing and listening and seeing anything. And people will say, well, I kind of like, I'm aware that I'm in the room and I'm sleeping. No, you need to actually get to a point where your body and your physical mind are completely asleep. And at that point, you bring forward your conscious awareness. And at that point, you have the blank slate. The blank slate comes down. And on that blank slate, it's like a big chalkboard. You begin to draw the pictures of where you want to go and what you want to see. And until you can get to that blank slate, you're never really going to be able to achieve direction in where you want to go and what you want to see.
What is the most useful thing about lucid dreaming? Why should we want to do it?
It is personal spiritual evolution. This is my quick answer. I think that there is an aspect of ourselves that is our inner self, the self within. I think for centuries and through different civilizations, we've been aware that there's the outer you and there's the inner you. The inner you is the part you keep hidden, even from yourself. The inner you is your inner spirit. The inner you is your super consciousness. It is your inner light. It is the part of you that brought you in. It's the part of you that keeps you straight. It's the part of you that knows kind of where you're going. And it's the part of you that whispers in your ear. It is your inner self. Your inner self will sometimes allow you to see things when it feels that you're ready for it. And that is when we have these sporadic dreams that we call lucid dreams. Most of us don't know how to set up a dream, but we have them sporadically. And they're very amazing. And since they happen sporadically and we haven't planned them, they're sometimes confusing. And we think that we've seen something very significant. The truth is that our inner self longs to grow and experience and embark on adventures of great discovery. It is the inner part of you that is your champion. It is the part of you that's on the arc of a hero's journey. It is the part of you that wants to break free, embark on a great adventure of self-discovery. And in every hero's journey, the arc of the hero's journey will take you to points of challenge and opportunities and growth, so that we, in the course of this adventure, we will have transformation in our lives, transforming who we are and evolving as a person. It is a part of our personal evolution.
The question of others in the dream, one of the things that has happened occasionally to me and has many close encounter witnesses describe this also, pardon me, of having non-human beings enter the dream, come
Yes.
walking into it. I've had that happen and it's really
Yes.
startling. And they seem to be completely at ease in that level of reality. Do you
Yes.
know anything about that? I don't recall seeing anything about it in the book. So maybe I'm going down a road here that you can't go down. But let me, what is your response to that?
No, I'm familiar with your books and to a degree, and I appreciate the question. I truly do. My own experience is that I have encountered things in my dreams that I would call non-human. In my experience, however, and this might be just a case of how I interpret it and how I filter it in my own consciousness, they tend to be animals. I've had a lot of what you call shamanic encounters, where I see animals in my dreams, and the animals will relay information to me non-verbally, of course, since we don't speak the same language. But I find that in my study of dreams in the shamanic world, that a lot of shamans will have gone on spiritual quests beyond space and time, and what we might call dreams, backward or forward in time, and even taught it to others in their community as vision quests. And in these vision quests, people will routinely have animal guides or animal spirits, which will interact with them. Now, I don't think this is exactly what you were saying, but I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. Outside of the physical world, if we can reliably interpret what we're seeing and understand from whence it comes.
When I was a little boy, I had a dog called Candy. She was a little terrier, and we were really close. We were just as that was the perfect boy-dog friendship, and we did everything together. She slept at the foot of the bed. We were, as I say, inseparable. And we got to take another break now, but when we get back, I want to ask you about a recurring lucid dream that's very unusual, very powerful, and involves this dog. We'll be right back.
Great.
We're back, and when I was a little boy, 7 years old, my mother took me out to a place where they had dogs. And they had terriers, little terriers, black and white terriers. And we were looking at the puppies with the idea of buying me a dog. And mother said, "Don't pick one out. Your dog will find you. And just stand here." And so I stood there. And soon one of the dogs came up to the puppies, came up and started looking at me, and then raised up and put her paws on the little fence, and Mama said, "Here's your dog." And we bought the dog and came home, and I had the privilege of naming the dog, and it turned out she really liked Candy. She used to steal my father's caramels from him and then take them under the couch, and if he tried to get them, she'd bite him. She wouldn't let him have them. So I called her Candy. And as I say, my boyhood was very significantly involved with Candy. And in the past 25 or 30 years, the following thing has happened about every 3 or 4 years. I will be sleeping, and I'll be. And this happened when Anne was alive too, and so it's and I find myself stroking Candy, and I sort of half wake up, and I'm stroking Candy, and she's lying there in the bed right beside me, just as vividly as if she was completely physically alive. And I'm thinking, and I think to I'm enjoying her presence, and I used to it used to really calm me down when I would stroke her in the night like that. And then suddenly it occurs to me, well, wait a minute, how old is Candy? She must be 70. But wait a that and then she disappears. That's a lucid dream, I think.
Yes.
Is it
The,
somehow real? Do you think she's there? Because I do.
well, I think that, I mean, now that you bring it up, I think that no one ever really dies. We simply go on to another level of existence. And I think in a dream state, we can go there, where
Yeah.
we're not bound by the laws of physicality anymore. And I dream all the time of my previous pets. And what my experience with this, similar to yours with Candy, is that I will every now and then have a dream where a lot of my cats, because I mostly had cats, will come together, and I'll have a dream with all of them from different times in my life, and one of the cats will always come forward at the end of the dream, this kind of reunion, and kind of impart to me the message that I organized this one, I got them together for you. I think that's so special, and I think it's so real, and I think it's so valid, and I think it's, well, first of all, I think my smell test is that it's not something in my memory. Yes, I have a memory of all of these animals that have been in my life, but I have no memory like this. So this is not a relived memory. This is not in my frame of reference. This is no part of my analytical mind. This is something newly created. This is actually happening in real time. This is actual. This is real. I think that we can visit with our loved ones of the past who know no time barrier. They are
Yes.
A part of us. They are connected to us forever.
Is it easier to call like your the your beloved dead into your dreams than it is to say have a shared lucid dream with someone who's alive? And is it and if you do and you succeed, then what do you how do you interact with them?
Yeah, I think that they're kind of waiting for it, you know. I kind of wait for them to call me because I don't want to disturb them from wherever they are. But I think once they call to you, and they approach you in a dream state, that you have to honor the visit. You know, it's kind of like their call, you know. So
yes.
You let them you say what they want to say. You know, you're there for them, you know, at least as much or more so than the other way around, and you honor the spirit in which they've come to you.
Now you talk about dream guides. What? How do you, if you're embarking on a program of lucid dreaming, it would be very helpful to have a dream guide who knew what they were doing. How do you call a real dream guide?
So in my experience, when I first started this, it was during a snowstorm on Mount Hood in 1980. And I had a lucid dream and I wanted to continue. And I started embarking on a great study of yoga consciousness and how to set up a dream. And I found out that there were those before me who had done this successfully. And we now call them samadhi mystics or people who practice Raja Yoga. And I wanted a dream guide. And I wanted a dream guide because I had nobody there to help me. I was not a samadhi student. I did not have anyone to train me or guide me in the practice of lucid dreaming. And so I said, you know, the first thing that happens is that I would begin to like arise above the room and I would become consciously aware that I was free to leave, but I didn't know quite how to negotiate how to get there. And I didn't quite know where to go. And I also felt worried that what if I could get to where I wanted to go, that I would be able to get back. I had a lot of questions. So I was just kind of like the nervous first-time traveler, let's say. And so I said, you know what? I need a teacher or a guide. And I started to once again employ creative visualization to visualize and then ultimately manifest a dream guide. And I began to actually think of what characteristics a dream guide would have. And I pictured a teacher who would actually take me like a student by the hand, and take me around and show me things. And finally, ultimately, I discovered that to truly visualize and ultimately manifest something through visualization, one must take one more final step of actually visualizing having accomplished this. Because if you don't visualize accomplishing it, it's not in the matrix. It won't be visual. It won't be reality. It won't be accomplished. So ultimately, I discovered that how to do this. And finally, in one of my first attempts to do lucid dreaming on my own, someone took my hand and directed me. And I had what I called my dream teacher. And my dream teacher said, well, you know, what do you want to know? Where do you want to go? And I said, Gina, I don't know anything of where I need to go. You need to show me some things. So she took me on a great adventure of things that she thought were were important. And I said, this isn't exactly what I had in mind. And she said, what did you have in mind? And she said, until you can determine where you want to go, it's going to be hard to actually have any kind of lucid dreaming with you. So ultimately, I visualized a dream teacher, and the dream teacher appeared. Now, I think a lot of people have said, well, I magically summoned her. No. I actually visualized her. And I think what happens in visualization is that you send out the thought form, and the thought form actually takes shape, and it actually bounces around the earth until someone says, whoa, someone's calling me. And then someone like that actually receives the message, because it's just simply, communication. There's the sender, the message, and then the medium, and then the receiver. And the receiver gets the message, and then tracks it down to the sender, and then said, oh, here, you called, and appears. So my dream guide was always out there. I just visualized who it was. I selected someone, and that person appeared. And it, lo and behold, it worked out well until she said, "No, I can't help you. You're kind of hopeless." And she passed me off on another dream teacher. And she said, "This is my teacher. He's more patient than I am, and I haven't got the patience to work with you because you don't really know what you want." And I said, "You're right." So, but she would check up on me, and she never really let go of me. And even though she severed the tie as my dream guide, my dream teacher would occasionally look in on me. Subsequently, I would encounter her when I was working on my Kirlian camera experiments. I would encounter her in the course of a day. And I can report to you that people who were with me actually saw her, and I could get them on your show, and they could testify that they saw her, and they could describe her as accurately as I knew her. Now, the person who ultimately became my dream guide, her teacher, was a bit more obscure, and I would only encounter him by finding him. He wouldn't not come and take me by the hand. He had a different way of operating. I think that there are dream teachers and guides out there, and all you need to do is visualize one, and you will get one.
That's very interesting because you remind me of something that happened so long ago. It almost I know it was a dream, but it doesn't feel like a dream. It feels sort of like a something kind of between dream and reality. And it was that I found myself with a sort of a guide. But the sort of part was that I knew this guide from my childhood. It was my 8th grade school teacher, a nun called Mother Rose Gonzalez. And she said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure." And she said, "I thought as much. That doesn't surprise me at all." And I said, "Well, what am I supposed to do?" She said, "You boys, you never can figure a thing out." And that was it. Oh, no, I remember. I asked her about religion. I'm sorry, but I forgot this. I asked her, what is our religion? Is it true?" We were, of course, Catholics. And she said, "Not as we were taught." And then she disappeared. When we get back, I'd like to talk about something we have touched on but not really discussed, the hero's journey. Those of you on the free side, thanks for watching and listening. Vaughn and subscribers, we'll be right back. We're talking to Vaughn Brashler. We're talking about his book, his Lucid Dreaming book. You've seen its cover a number of times over the course of the show. Why not go to the unknowncountry.com store and buy it? And in the process, also take a look at my books, which are signed copies available. Vaughn, before we paused, and this time for the subscribers, it's always a very short pause. Before we paused, we were getting ready to talk about the hero's journey, which is a very interesting part of your book and your own journey. Can you talk about, tell us first, what is your vision of the hero's journey and how does it fit into lucid dreaming?
Well, you know, we have in classical literature and psychology the concept that the hero's journey is embarked on by a daring hero who leaves the known world behind to embark on a great journey of discovery, fraught with dangers, to go into an unknown world beyond and to leave the sanctity of what is considered home. Then the hero then embarks on this journey and accepts what's called the call to action. And then the hero then classically will be confronted by a gatekeeper almost immediately who said, no, you don't want to go on this hero's journey. It's way too perilous. It is way too challenging. It is beyond you. It's fraught with danger. And I don't think you should go. And furthermore, I won't let you go. So the first thing is to overcome the gatekeeper. Now, then the second thing is you're going to receive challenges along the way on this great journey, which we consider a lonely solo adventure. But along the way, you will encounter allies. Some will be like supernatural, and some will be just like people along the way that are also on this path of discovery. This is very much like the pilgrim's journey. It is very much like the spiritual journey. There are many parallels to the hero's journey. And then ultimately, the hero will encounter all these great challenges, like the great Ulysses, Jason of the Argonauts. You have all kinds of examples of the hero's journey. And I throw in this the story of Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, a great, great journey. And then it is an unknown world fraught with danger and mystery. And along the way, one comes to a point of no return. The point of no return is also known in spiritual terms as the great abyss or the great, the dark hour of the soul. And this is a point where one considers abandoning the journey and returning or continuing on. And then if you continue on, you are really in it. You're in it to sink or swim. And then and the journeys don't get any easier, but there will be like allies along the way, as well as obstacles and threats along the way. And then one receives ultimately transformation of the soul, and one becomes more than the sum of all parts. One becomes larger than life. One becomes transformed by the actual journey, and receives then what's called treasures or sometimes they're called gifts of the goddess. If you think of like in terms of Odysseus, where the goddess will then bestow gifts. Now the gifts are often like fair weather or fortunate winds that blow your way. There'll be opportunities, and moreover, there'll be enrichments to one's self, which are intrinsic. and one then gains insight and stature and growth through the experience of the journey, returning ultimately back home. I think that the dream, and in more than just the dream experience, but our lives are really lined with the opportunity of encountering our own hero's journey and going on the arc of discovery. If you think of how you enter the lucid dream, it's like a challenge. And then one must accept the challenge to go on the journey. And you prepare for the journey. You know, you don't just jump off. You say, I'm going to go in from the known world to the unknown world. That is the dreamscape. And then you go beyond the physical realm into the world of dreams. And you're entering into a spirit realm, right? This is an unknown world. There'll be all kinds of challenges and opportunities. There'll be gatekeepers. There'll be all kinds of strange confrontations along the way. And yes, there'll be non-physical or supernatural encounters along the way. And one must be willing to actually complete the arc of discovery to become enriched by the dream experience. But dream work is filled with opportunity and the potential for transformation as one returns home from the dream.
Now, you mentioned we've talked a number of times about different entities and guides entering our dream world, and there is it's actually quite crowded out there. There's a lot going on. Not all of it is fun. Not all of it's helpful. And what do we do to make sure that we don't get tangled up with someone or something that we don't want to have in our lives?
Yeah, exactly. One of my first teachers was Lewis Gittner. He was quite an amazing man. And he said, you know, beware that there are people that will pull on you when you enter these realms, that you enter the dream state. And he taught me, like, straight up that it was going to be the dreamscape was going to be an adventure beyond the physical into a spirit realm where there were supernatural forces at work. And he said, they're not all going to be kindly. Some are going to try to exploit you, you know. And he said, be, you know, aware. And what happens is in a lucid dream, one brings along the journey conscious awareness. One brings conscious empowerment so that you do have in a sense greater powers than you do, a different set of powers than you do in the physical realm. You can fly, disappear and reappear in somewhere else. You do have what we would consider like superpowers. And while we might be amazed in the dreamscape at all the challenges and supernatural confrontations that seem to be around every corner, we ourselves have supernatural powers and opportunities around every corner. But it is important in a dream to be keenly aware that you're in the dream, and consciously aware that you have abilities to take you to other places in the dream. You are not naked. You are not that vulnerable as you might think.
I've had an out of body experience where I couldn't get back into my body. And that gets me to this question of out of body versus lucid dreaming. is an out-of-body experience, do you think maybe they're related and maybe an out-of-body experience is an extreme version of a lucid dream where an entire consciousness literally comes out of your body?
So they're very similar, aren't they? I think that, well, in a lucid dream, you're going to have an out-of-body experience by definition, but an out-of-body experience could happen apart from a lucid dream. It could be accidentally a case of stepping out of your body. I think this is what happens sometimes, maybe in time slips, for instance, that one will slip somewhere. And you've done it unconsciously, let's say, and then you say, "Oh my gosh, how do I get back?" Because you don't have the conscious awareness that one might have in having set up a lucid dream. So you slipped in a sense from one level of being to another level of being. In other words, you've gone maybe into an astral realm or an alternate realm unconsciously. And that's a bit disconcerting because you wonder how you got there, first of all, and then you wonder how you're going to get back.
You talk in the book about visiting parallel lives through lucid dreaming. And let me give a, what do you mean by that, parallel lives? Can you explain that to us a little bit?
Yeah, I think that our thought forms create a reality that we sometimes inhabit and sometimes we visit. And I think that our thought forms have created alternate realities for all of us that will sometimes be visited by us. And are happening concurrent to this more physically apparent and highly visible world we call the here and now. And I think that some of us are consciously, not consciously, but somewhat aware of this other reality, and that it's happening concurrent to this reality. It is a parallel life. It is a parallel universe. It is a parallel realm. And sometimes I wonder if the other me in the other realm is having more fun. I'm only aware of one. I don't know if there's more than one other. I don't think I could keep track of more than two of me. But I do think that every one of us has a parallel reality somewhere, and it might be not as concretely formed in all cases. It is a kind of a twilight reality. It is happening at the same time that we're living this life.
Yeah, it because it I've been very involved with that. I've written a lot about living experiencing a parallel reality in my books. I've had physical journeys into such realities, but that's not what we're talking about today. So yeah, but I'm just saying that I wholeheartedly agree with you. What about karmic attraction, which is very interesting? Part you, I think it's in it's it, when you're discussing parallel lives visited in dreams, you mentioned you bring up karmic attraction. Could you tell us a little bit about what that means to you and what it might mean to us?
Yeah, I mean, to me, karma and karmic attraction and electromagnetic attraction are all kind of like basically the same. I think that there is a karmic attraction, for instance, that one of the questions I get asked about setting up lucid dreams is, how do I get back? How do I know I can get back? You know, if I actually am going to leave the room and go somewhere else in my consciousness, I'm going to go there in my subtle energy bodies, and I'm going to be more there than here. And the only part of me that's left behind is this bag of bones, which I call my physical self. And it's like, how do I like get back? And I think the ultimate answer is there's a karmic attraction. There's a karmic attraction to who you've been, who you will be, and your in your parallel lives. It connects your physicality to all your subtle energy bodies, to all your other aspects of oneself, both now and forever. And I think that those who have come into contact with you, my teacher Lewis would love this. They hold a special hold upon you. That is to say that anyone who's been close to you in your life will have this special karmic attraction, this bond which can never really be broken. You simply need to think of this person and you're there. And this is true of our parallel lives. It is true of our past lives. It is true of those who have come into close contact with us. We have an attraction to this.
Yeah,
It's magnetic.
right. It's like, when you meet someone and you marry them, I mean, it's very often like that. It was with my wife. The attraction was totally magnetic and overwhelming. We met, went to a movie together, and were never apart again for 45 years. So that was intense. I mean, yeah, we were apart every once in a while when I went on author tours, but basically we were never apart again till she passed on, and now we're still not apart because she still is with me from time to time, not as much as she was at the beginning of her afterlife, but from time to time she still checks in on me. Now, what would you say is the greatest danger of lucid dreaming? Because I think that one of the things that stops people is fear, even fear that they don't acknowledge consciously. And we kind of need to work with that, I think, before we can comfortably go into lucid dreaming easily, because it's really hard to do it to enact a lucid dream, to decide I'm going to have a lucid dream. Your book, by the way, is an excellent. It's very good. I read this book, and I wasn't even trying to use the methods in it. And I proceeded to I've had two or three lucid dreams in the past week
Oh,
after
great.
reading this book.
Great.
Just reading it. I didn't even try to do any of the exercises or anything. Okay, so what is the greatest danger? When someone says to you, "Oh, I'd love to do this, but I'm scared." What do you say?
There's certain things that you're afraid of. One is losing control. And this is actually comes not deep within you, but very superficially. One's physical mind then is acting as a gatekeeper and will not allow you to go beyond. And we think of the mind as controlling everything, and it controls our autonomic functions of our body. It keeps us breathing. It keeps blood flowing. It's miraculous. It is a controlling factor in our lives. It is controlling our safety. It is controlling our environment. It is telling us, be careful. And so it's a limiting factor. And so it is very important to reach a level of wholeness and harmony to where our analytical mind or physical brain will feel comfortable in allowing a little quiet time where it and the trade-off is that it gets some quality downtime and rest. where you return from a lucid dream, typically much more rested and comfortable than in a normal sleep environment. Lucid dreaming will allow you to reach new levels of physical relaxation and rest. But then there's the fear that when if you leave in a great adventure of self-discovery in such a lucid dream, that you will be able to negotiate your way. And then there's the fear that you will lose yourself in the dream. I think this is often the case. And then there's the fear that you'll be able to return, and once again, karmic attraction, the all that you need to do is think back to the connection you have to your physical self in this life, this physical life of yours, and you'll instantly be back in your body. It is magnetic. Bang, you're home. It happens that quickly. You don't have the sensation of going on any great journey to return to your body. So it is very much like, once again, the hero's journey, in that in going on a lucid dream, one packs for a great adventure. One does a lot of planning advisedly, because it's going to be an outbound journey of great discovery and opportunity, and you know that it's going to be beyond this realm, this known world, and you have to have the confidence that you're in control of yourself during a lucid dream. To reach a state of lucid dreaming, one must get control of the harmony in the body, the body attunement, that there would be a sense of the body working together and not in a guarded fashion, protected fashion.
Vaughn, I think that's a good place for us to conclude our journey into lucid dreaming together. Lucid Dreaming, Vaughn Brashler, well worth reading. And as I say, just reading it got me into lucid dreaming again after quite a few years. So it's obviously works and it's worth it. Vaughn, and I so enjoyed talking to you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.